This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
I wish we taught more in our schools about the Islamic faith. I wish we talked about all the great confessional faiths. And what people don't realize is one of my avocations is theology.
It's interesting that the sort of like traditional American leftism is clashing with, you know, millennial progressivism.
The Reformation was not a revolution. And thinking we have to take on and imitate the worship styles and practices of non-sacramental Christians is very dangerous.
I think the first thing is just knowing the arguments about the truth of the matter. That's why shows like yours, Issues, Etc., are so important, because you're equipping people to make the argument.
Iowa State University computer science graduates love Issues, Etc.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Someone might say Christians have their Jesus and Muslims have their who? Well, I guess the closest thing might be Muhammad. But why would that parallel stand up? Jesus made some claims about himself that Muhammad never made. Muslims make claims about Muhammad and Jesus that Jesus never made. How do you compare these two figures? One, I assert, the very Son of God in human flesh. And the other, well, he claimed to be a prophet of the Most High God, but has led countless millions astray and, let's be honest, to hell. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from our virtual Making the Case conference on the campus of Concordia University, Chicago. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in and watching. We're going to talk about Jesus and Muhammad. Dr. Adam Francisco joins us. He's Assistant Provost for Mission and Identity at Concordia University Chicago. Next year, he'll be the founding dean of the College of Theology, Arts, and Humanities at CUC. Previously served as a professor in the Department of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California. And he's author of the book Martin Luther and Islam and co-editor of Making the Case for Christianity. Dr. Francisco, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd.
Why do people make the parallel between Jesus and Muhammad?
I think, especially nowadays, because there's been so much emphasis, or misemphasis maybe is the right word, on the similarities of Islam and Christianity. I mean, there are parallel similarities, but they don't converge pretty much at all. But with the syncretism that's sort of run amok. I guess it always runs amok, but that's pretty popular these days. I think people are looking at for connections.
So people assume that Christianity and Islam are close enough together that we could draw a parallel between their primary figures.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, oftentimes Islam and Christianity and Judaism are called Abrahamic religions. And so there's just this, and if you have somebody who's not trained theologically or doesn't look too closely at the details or the facts, you see in Islam, Muhammad, though he's by no means regarded by Muslims as an incarnation of God or whatever, but he's very much at the center of Islam. Muslims don't really call their religion Muhammadanism, but there's a reason why it has been called Muhammadanism for centuries, because of the centrality of Muhammad in that faith. The Quran says over and over again that Muslims are to obey Allah and to obey the Prophet Muhammad. So everything that Muhammad said or did or is believed to have said and did is taken as inspired, inerrant word and example from God.
As far as we can tell, how did Muhammad regard Jesus?
Well, as far as we can tell, if we take the Quran at face value, if we assume that the Quran is a fairly accurate transcription of what Muhammad taught. And there's a lot of reason to doubt that, but let's just assume it's true. He says quite a bit about Jesus. He says that he is a prophet in the lineage of Jesus and Moses and a whole bunch of other prophets that are biblical prophets. He says that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary, that he performed miracles from raising people from the dead, healing the sick, restoring sight to the blind and others. Where things get interesting in the Quran and the things that Muhammad allegedly said is that in one place in the Quran it says that the line goes, it's in chapter 4, it says the Jews boast that they killed the Messiah Jesus. They did not kill him, nor was he crucified. So while Muhammad believed that Jesus existed, that he performed miracles, that he was born of a virgin, he did not, at the end of his life, die a death on the cross. Instead, Muhammad goes on and says that Jesus was taken up into heaven. And there, Muslim theologians, Quranic commentators for centuries have sort of filled in the details on how that all happened. The majority, or the more popular position, is that Judas had his face transformed and he was arrested and crucified in Jesus' place, and then Allah caused Jesus to be raised up into the heavens.
What do we know about Muhammad himself? How clear is the picture there?
That's a tough one to answer from a historian's perspective. It used to be thought, following in the, I guess, the tradition or the words of an old French scholar, 19th century French scholar, who was also part of the historical Jesus quest. His name was Renan. And he wrote a book on the life of Jesus where he basically discounted everything in the Gospels as historically reliable. But when he made a comment in another book on Muhammad and says, Muhammad grew up in the full light of history. And the way that's been assumed or taken is that the source material we have on Muhammad is much better for the historian to work with than the source material on Jesus. Now, I would argue, and there are certainly others who would, that it's actually the opposite that's the case. The earliest biography we have of Muhammad, a physical biography, a manuscript, dates to about 200 years after his death, a little less. It's claims to be written or taken from a biography that was written 100 years after his death, but we don't have that first one. The story in this earliest manuscript of Muhammad's life is, you know, a lot of it reads like sort of mundane history. But then there are some really wild tales in there of when Muhammad was born, for example. It says that out of the birth canal, a great light shone or came forth and illuminated the whole globe. There's other miracles of Muhammad splitting the moon in half and half of it falling down out of the sky, going in one sleeve and coming out the other sleeve. And you know, miracles like that. And it's not just because there's claims that miracles happen. That's not the reason why I would throw or be suspicious of them. It's that all the miracles in the biography are written in such a way that there's no way you could test them. That is, you couldn't. There were no eyewitnesses. So it's hard to know what to take as fairly accurate in the biographies. The Quran was not written in Muhammad's life, but it certainly, we have really good evidence that it was written down probably within about 50, maybe 70 years of his life. So that's probably a little better source. But if you've read the Quran, I know you at least read parts of it, it's a chronological mess. It's hard to follow. You really need the biography, and you need to use the biography of Muhammad to sort of provide a lens through which to interpret the Quranic text.
How would you describe Muhammad's theology? Christianity is deeply, deeply doctrinal. Is that true of Islam?
In part. There certainly are doctrines in Islam. The Quran's pretty clear that there are five essential doctrines that every Muslim, whether they're Sunni, Shia, or something in between, has to hold or maintain to be a Muslim in good standing, if you will. That's the doctrine of Tawheed, the unicity or the oneness of Allah, that Allah is one, that he has no partners. The Quran says in about a half a dozen places, He does not have a son. Second major doctrine is the doctrine of, if you will, a belief in there being two worlds, a visible world and an invisible world that includes angels and jinn or genies. Then you have the doctrine of the books and the doctrine of the prophets, which says that Islam is not a new religion, but rather there were books before the Quran that revealed the nature of God. There were prophets before Muhammad, extending back to Adam, that were maybe not in name Islamic, but the content of their teaching was Islamic. And then the last doctrine would be the doctrine of the last day. So those are the cornerstone doctrines. Muslims, if you looked at the history of Islamic literature, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find, at least before the 20th century, a text that looks like a work of systematic theology, or even a symbolic book, like a comprehensive book on the major doctrines and their finer points in the Islamic tradition. Tariq Ramadan, who's up until very recently been sort of described as the most influential Western Muslim, he's now in prison, but wrote in a book that there is no theology in Islam the way that Christians have done theology. At best, what Muslims do when it comes to theology over the course of their history is a prolegomena or an apologetic type of theology, but that's it. Because Muslims are very wary of adding anything to or describing what's found in the Quranic text apart from just using Quranic citations. I mean, it's a very proof-texty, fundamentalist approach to theology.
We're talking about Jesus and Muhammad on this Friday, July the 24th. We're broadcasting from the Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference on the campus of Concordia University, Chicago, where Dr. Adam Francisco serves as Assistant Provost for Mission and Identity. When we come back, how did he come to be regarded as the prophet of Allah?
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Your church's chrismons are from the 80s. They're made of styrofoam, their glitter is shedding, and they're held together with toothpicks. Now is the perfect time to replace them with AdCruisman's Christmas in July sale. Participating artists have discounted their products, so stock up on jewelry, crucifixes, art, church banners, music, greeting cards, and more. Discounts range from 10 to 50% off. Visit us at adcruisman.com to take advantage of the sale. That's adcruisman.com.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. We're broadcasting live on this Friday, July the 24th, talking about Jesus and Muhammad with Dr. Adam Francisco, author of the book Martin Luther and Islam. So was Muhammad regarded as the prophet of Allah during his lifetime, or did that kind of become his story from his later followers?
Well, the Islamic tradition would say he was recognized slowly or incrementally. If you read the biographies, and even you get traces of it in the Quran itself, when Muhammad gets his start in like around 610 AD and has this experience in a cave where he hears a voice and feels a presence and so on, when he comes out and starts telling people about this experience, the people who believe him are very few. His cousin Ali, who will be the central figure of Shia Islam, and his wife Khadija will acknowledge him or start to see him as a prophet. 10 years in Mecca, he does. You know, the numbers are still very low, and in fact, a persecution breaks out because they see Muhammad as upsetting the religious status quo. Mecca was a polytheistic kind of hub for the Arabian Peninsula, where most of the people living there made their income maintaining and charging entrance fees to the Kaaba, that big square-like structure. And Muhammad's preaching against that type of religion. So persecution breaks out. There are attempts on Muhammad's life, and eventually he flees to Medina. Now that's where people start to recognize him, at least large numbers, as a prophet. But in many ways, it was by force, or at least political persuasion. So by the end of his life, so he dies in 632, we're told that most of the Arabian Peninsula, by politics mostly, but also in some cases, actually quite a few cases of military might, the other Arabian tribes are forced into at least an alliance where they nominally embrace Muhammad as what they call Rasulullah, a messenger of Allah. Now, there aren't really, at least history doesn't know, there's no evidence of people outside of the Arabian Peninsula, outside of the political orbit of Muhammad who recognize him as a prophet. That happens in the century following his death, but it was almost universally imposed on people, where they're given not necessarily ultimatums of life and death, but they're forced by the political powers that be to at least acknowledge Muhammad as a prophet, nominally speaking.
You mentioned the Quran. Do we know if the Quran came from Muhammad himself?
Do we know? We don't. And this is it is a controversial position. The traditional story in Islam is that when Muhammad's a prophet, starting in 610 AD, for those 22 years before he dies, as he's teaching, as he's going about his day-to-day life doing things, that his followers were memorizing everything he said under inspiration. And some of them, the Islamic tradition says, wrote some of these things down on leather and stone and other things. The story from Islamic sources is that about 20 years after Muhammad's death, the Muslims they took his last words as marching orders, where he told his followers as he's dying that he had been called by Allah, and now the Muslim Ummah, or the Muslim community, is also called by Allah to pursue or fight the world, and to the world confesses there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. And so when that happens, and the first great jihad, as it's sometimes referred to, the most zealous of the Muslims, the ones who had memorized everything Muhammad said under inspiration, are on the front lines of the battle, and they're dying off. So one of the early rulers of Islam decided that it was time, around 650 AD, to write down what Muhammad said. And there was a debate that broke out whether it should be written down, because Muhammad never said to write it down. And so, after the debate, eventually the ruler, a caliph, his name was Uthman, got his way, and it was written down. The story is that anybody who is still living, a widow of Muhammad or somebody who, one of his companions from the early days, were brought to Medina, and they were also ordered to bring anything that they had written down Muhammad said to Medina. And over the course of some days, weeks, maybe even years, it's all transcribed into one book. Now, Islamic sources, the most respected Islamic sources, almost canonical sources like the Hadith, say that once that text was written down, and it was distributed among people, companions of Muhammad, a lot of them came back and said, we don't remember him saying this, or that shouldn't be in there. And because it caused a lot of trouble in the Muslim community. And so Uthman, the guy who was behind the project in the first place, ordered that every source, everything, anything that somebody had written down from Muhammad's lifetime should be burned. So we don't know. We do have, if you'll let me or indulge me, there is the probably the earliest manuscript of the Quran that we have dates to the late 7th century. It was discovered in an attic in a mosque in Yemen in the late 1970s. And when they brought in the German scholar who's the expert on that style of calligraphy and dating manuscripts, they were able to date it within the century of Muhammad's death. And what they found, though, with the manuscript is that while it compares fairly well with modern printed editions of the Arabic Quran, as they looked more closely at the manuscript, they noticed that there was a couple layers to the text. They call it a palimpsest. And I guess in old manuscripts, because it's expensive to use animal skin to write things, if a scribe's writing something down and he makes a mistake, they didn't just throw it out. They just wiped it off with water and then they'd write over it. I guess there's three layers to it. And what Gerd Puhin, this German scholar, has discovered is that the Quran actually went through a process of revision. We don't know how, but that's a pretty well-established fact. So all in all, what this tells us is that the Muslim claim that you'll hear more often than not amidst like real serious Muslims, that the written Quran is a perfect copy of everything Muhammad said, that just can't be true. Not that we'd believe it anyway, but the facts say otherwise.
But Muslims are taught, thoroughgoing Muslims are taught that he got this stuff from an angel in the cave and that he did not write it down himself, but that he had it written down and that it's pristine.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And it corresponds perfectly with this copy that is apparently in heaven with Allah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you get the weeds, it gets really detailed. There is a heavenly, almost like golden tablets, if you will, up in heaven. And the angel Jibril or Gabriel would bring down periodically, as Allah instructed him, words from that tablet to Muhammad, who would speak those words. And then eventually they're remembered by people later on, and that's written down. And the whole process, so the writing down was all orchestrated, directly orchestrated by Allah, so that scribes don't make mistakes.
All right, a couple more questions before the break. Why is today, among many Muslims, any criticism or even a depiction of the Prophet Allah, why is that considered tantamount to blasphemy?
Well, the real short, simple answer is the fear is that if you have images of Muhammad, they'll start to be venerated. And, it'll be like a graven image or an idol. At least historically, that's why there's been... That's not to say there haven't been Muslims who have depicted Muhammad. There have, but they're mostly those on the margins of Orthodox Islam. Nowadays, with all the tension, another reason is, at least the way it's been... I asked a friend of mine, a pretty austere Muslim, what the big deal was. And he says, mostly nowadays, the big concern is that if they allow it, then non-Muslims will start drawing images of Muhammad, and then you see what happens, like with in France, the Charlie Hebdo affair, and down in Texas, the Draw the Muhammad Day, I think it was called. So, that really is it. Muslims feel themselves, they would say, the refrain I've heard is that Allah doesn't need to be defended. He can defend himself. Muhammad, however, being a man, does need to be defended. And as part of the sort of, if you will, jihad in Islam, the struggle to advance and defend Islam, a part of that is defending the honor of the so-called prophet.
What line of Islam best represents the teachings of Muhammad as far as we can discern them?
Sunni Islam. That's about 85% to 90% of the Muslim world. There are different schools of thought within Sunni Islam, especially concerning what is lawful and what is prohibited in Islam, the law. In terms of the theology, there are no variations in Sunni Islam. It's those five doctrines that we talked about earlier. the only differences are over things like tastes and what is whether you can play chess or not. Some schools of Sunni Islam say, yes, you can play chess. Others say no. Whether you must grow a beard if you're able to or not is another thing that divides them. But Islam is not monolithic. There are divisions within Islam, but they're not major divisions in Sunni Islam, at least, over points of doctrine.
We're talking about Jesus and Muhammad. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest, Assistant Provost for Mission and Identity at Concordia University Chicago, and author of the book Martin Luther and Islam. Religion and politics is the theme of the August issue of the Lutheran Witness magazine. It contains columns from Issues Etc. guest Dr. Joel Bierman on American voting and the Christian conscience, Having Hard Conversations in a Loving Way with Dr. Corey Moss and Dr. Robert Benny on the connection between religion and politics. The Lutheran Witness is available in print and online. Learn more at cph.org/witness. Interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective, the Lutheran Witness magazine, cph.org/witness. On the other side, we'll turn to Jesus. Who and what did he claim to be?
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our study of St. Matthew from exile back home, the Savior's birth, wise men from the East, worship of the King, and flight into Egypt. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
The COVID-19 pandemic has caused many Christians to ask about whether or not the government should be telling the church when and how to gather around our Lord's gifts. In the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Christopher Thoma takes up this question in his article titled, Executive Orders, Divine Command. To read this excellent article and more about the church's life in the midst of a pandemic, subscribe to the Lutheran Witness today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
This is Major A.J. Vogel, United States Army.
And this is Pastor Josh Leigaber of Trinity Lutheran Church, a confessional liturgical congregation located at Leesville and Fort Polk, Louisiana.
If you ever find yourself at Fort Polk, we invite you to join us to receive the gifts of Christ in word and sacrament.
For more information, visit us on Facebook or at trinityleesville.com.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.
We're discussing Jesus and Muhammad with Dr. Adam Francisco of Concordia University, Chicago. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc., broadcasting live from our 2020 virtual Making the Case conference. You can send a question or a comment to Dr. Francisco at talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org, or on Twitter at issuesetc. So we turn now to Jesus. Who and what did he claim to be?
Well, nothing short of the Son of God, co-eternal with the Father, the Son of Man, who would come at the end. I think if you compare the activity of Jesus to Muhammad, it's really quite, I mean, they are very different. For Muhammad, his telos or his end was this worldly, to create a caliphate, if you will, an Islamic government and with Islamic law and majority, if not all, Muslim people, whereas Jesus's telos or end is something is beyond time and space. It's the city of God. Jesus taught, well, certainly Jesus, of course, did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. With Muhammad, he establishes a new law. We could go on and on about the differences. Jesus, interestingly, if you compare the activity of Jesus, and especially when he encounters resistance, for Muhammad, on one occasion, there were a group of Jews, a tribe of Jews in Medina, that resisted his claims to prophethood. Whether they resisted his political claims as a governor of the city or not is hard to know, but his way of dealing with them was to call them out one morning, have them dig ditches, and the 700 to 900 Jewish men watch as their wives and children were taken into slavery, and then they have their heads cut off. Jesus is obviously, he's not a pacifist in the modern sense of the term, but his activity is not political. His kingdom is not of this world. When he was challenged, unlike Muhammad, who oftentimes fought his challengers, and when Jesus has his authority challenged, or when people like the Pharisees ask him on the basis of what authority do you make your claims, Jesus sometimes says things like, you'll get no sign except the sign of Jonah. So you see, with Muhammad, he wants you to believe him on force. For Jesus, he does things to cause or make you want to believe him, if that makes sense. I think of when the paralytic's lowered from the roof, he forgives him, and people are grumbling. The Pharisees are grumbling, and Jesus knows they're grumbling, and says, well, what's easier, to forgive sins or for me to say, get up and walk? So you maybe could say that Jesus is unlike any other religious leader or figure in human history. Muhammad's very much like other ones.
What does Jesus do to substantiate these claims, in particular the claims that he is the Son of the Eternal Father, that he is God in human flesh, and that he is, in fact, the Redeemer and Savior of all humanity?
Well, ultimately, it's the sign of Jonah. It's his death and his resurrection. I think there's a story, it's in a couple places in the Quranic text, where Jews and other non-believers approach Muhammad and say, why should we believe you? You seem like a charlatan. We will believe you, however, if you perform a sign. And Muhammad says, I've not been given to perform any miracles. But if there is a miracle, it's the stuff I'm saying. Whereas Jesus wants you to believe him on the basis of his word, to be sure. But in the face of unbelief, as in the case with Doubting Thomas, for example, he provides evidence, if you will. Not in the way that maybe a modern scientist, a repeatable type of evidence would demand, but he provides evidence. He meets people where they're at, whereas Muhammad is more of very much a sort of a top-down approach. You'll believe this or else.
So how should we then regard Jesus' miracles during his earthly ministry? Are they demonstrations not only of his own compassion toward those who are in need, but also demonstrations of his divinity?
I would think so. That's an interesting point. The miracles that Muhammad allegedly did didn't benefit anybody. They're done sort of privately.
parlor tricks, big parlor.
Yeah,
tricks.
Yeah. I mean, nobody was there to observe them anyway, but it's like they're just written in there. And there are Muslim scholars, more liberal-minded ones, who say these were written in as apologetic devices to give some credibility to Muhammad, because they perhaps know that there's no reason to believe Muhammad if he can't do anything that you and I can't do. When Jesus performs miracles, it's not just to, if you will, prove, I'm using air quotes for those who can't see, prove his divinity, but it affects or reaches or influences or speaks to, it's a long list, the deepest human needs. To be, for example, with death, when he raises Lazarus. So I would say that for Jesus' ministry, whereas Muhammad and his ministry is about an earthly kingdom, building up an Islamic state, for Jesus' ministry is to take care of every individual.
I wonder about if he comes saying, I'm here to set things right with God, whether or not his miracles demonstrate that as well. A little beginning of restoration of this creation.
Yeah, I should have said that as well. But, yeah. For Muhammad, there is a sense of restoration in Islam, but it's not a restoration of a relationship between God and humanity. It's just a restoration of some forgotten law from centuries ago.
Did Muhammad consider the kingdom that he was trying to bring into existence the kingdom of Allah? Would he have spoken of it as God's kingdom, or was it merely an earthly manifestation of Allah's will or something like that?
I think I would say it's the latter, or the emphasis. You can find both, but the emphasis is on the latter. It's on restoring or creating a properly ordered Islamic state. He doesn't use those words exactly, but that's his goal, where the law of Allah, the Sharia, is the law of the land. And everybody in following that law will be on the straight path. There is that's penultimate, though. There is some final destination as well. And that's, it's fairly popular, a little off color. That's where you get all the essential descriptions of paradise. That is the ultimate goal. While it's ultimate, it's not emphasized as much as the obligation of Muslims to create this Islamic order.
How should we regard the gospel accounts? There are many. You talked earlier about kind of the higher critical approach to both the gospel accounts and to Islamic texts. Should we regard those accounts the same way we regard the material on Muhammad?
No. So if I can drop the name of a book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, Richard Baucom. Not that everything in there we should agree with, but it establishes pretty well that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the material in there, in those texts, are from eyewitnesses. I would say Matthew and John are eyewitnesses. Mark and Luke are companions of eyewitnesses. They go right back to the time of Jesus. So the four Gospels, those are, as historical source material, much more reliable from a historian's vantage point than, say, the Quran or the biography of Muhammad. Maybe an additional point, if it's interesting when you look at how archaeology influences the way people understand the historicity of Jesus and Muhammad, there is a ton of archaeology. Paul Myers made a whole career on looking at how archaeology in the Holy Land can help us understand a bit more of the finer details of the narrative of Jesus' life. You can't do that with Muhammad. If you go into the Quranic text, there's very few places that are named that you can actually go and visit, with the exception of Mecca, Medina. The rest just don't exist. It's almost on the level, if you're familiar with or read parts of the Bhagavad Gita, this Hindu text, all these great stories of battles and things taking place, and they're nowhere. You can't locate these places because they don't really exist in time and space as you and I know it.
So it's more kind of like the Arthurian legend,
mm-hmm.
where it might be generally set in some place we know, but other than that, the places are all fanciful.
Yeah, it's not like, when you go take a tour of the Holy Land, you could take a gospel and kind of follow along. You couldn't do that with the Quran. Well, you wouldn't be allowed to in the first place, but let's say they opened up and they allowed you to. You couldn't do that. You go to Mecca, Medina, but everything else seems like legend.
All right, let's talk about a common assumption, and that is that Islam and Christianity have a common root. You spoke earlier about Abrahamic faiths, but first of all, what do people believe when they think that they have a common root, and is it true?
Yeah, well, you know, this claim that there are three Abrahamic faiths, that claim actually arises in part from Islamic theology and from the Quranic text itself. The Quran's, in many places, chapter 3 is probably the most explicit, regards Judaism and Christianity as precursors to Islam. And Judaism and Christianity were, if you were to get rid of what a traditional Muslim might regard as things that have been added to it, you would get to a sort of primordial Islam. So chapter 3, starting around verse 64, says that Jews and Christians debate over which of those religions are more in the lineage of Abraham. And Muhammad then jumps in and says, neither of them are. They go back in a way, but because they've added all these new doctrines, these new laws, they've deviated from the path of Abraham. Abraham, says Muhammad, was a Muslim. So that sentiment that there are Abrahamic faiths, some more genuine or more correspond better to what Abraham believed, is thoroughly Islamic. To regard Islam as an Abrahamic faith from a Christian perspective, I don't think that can be maintained unless you're just trying to play nicey-nice with Muslims. There's just no way to do it. In fact, when Islam claims that it's the Abrahamic faith, that Christianity was, but it deviated from it by corrupting the scriptures or adding new teachings, when it does that, it actually is doing it in as a polemical device, in that Muslims, and at least the Quran tells them, should be confident that when Christians especially hear the words of Allah recited, when the Quran is recited, that their eyes will well up with tears because they'll recognize the truth within. Because Christianity is somewhat close to Abraham, as is Judaism. But interestingly, 10 years ago now, there was this movement, it's still quite large, called the Common Word Between Us and You movement. People like Tony Blair, John Kerry, the former senator, have all gotten on board. And what it assumes is that Christianity and Islam, and then Judaism came along a little later, are all basically say the same thing. They just sort of practice different things. That's a common assumption in the, you know, amongst the masses, or among those who are involved in like interreligious dialogue and things like that. But if you look at the particulars, I mean, good heavens, the Quran itself is very hostile towards what we would regard as absolutely essential doctrines of Christianity. It says in chapter 9, verse 30, that the Jews regard Ezra as a sort of the son of God, and the Christians say that Jesus is the son of God. For these beliefs, may Allah forever curse them. End of chapter 4 says that, Muhammad saying to Christians, do not say more about Allah than what Allah really is. Do not say Tathlitha. Do not say he is three. Jesus was no more than a prophet. So Islam itself, at least historically in its primary text, is hostile to Christianity or Orthodox Christianity, and rejects those cornerstone doctrines. Interestingly, though, there is some anti-Semitism in Islamic culture. Even some of the more robust Islamic theologians historically have noted that Judaism is actually a little closer to Islam than Christianity. A lot of people assume it's different, but if you look doctrinally speaking, it's a little more aligned.
Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. We're talking about Jesus and Muhammad. When we come back, we'll do some more comparing and contrasting the teachings and the truth claims of Christianity and Islam. I'm Todd Wilke. This is Issues Etc., coming to you live from the 2020 virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
What is God calling you to do?
What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that for over 40 years, Lutheran Church Extension Fund has had the humble privilege of supporting Lutheran Church Missouri Synod ministries with low-cost loans and resources? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Because of faithful investors like you, we've been able to help church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations. To learn how you can get involved, call 800-843-8233.
Timeless truth that prepares scholars to serve their neighbor in all of life through their various vocations. This is what scholars receive at Wittenberg Academy. If you are looking for a solidly Lutheran online education for your child, consider Wittenberg Academy, where doctrine is sound, academics are rigorous, and relationships are genuine. We offer full-time, part-time, and diploma track options to meet your child's Lutheran education needs. We partner with brick-and-mortar schools and homeschools. You can find out more at wittenbergacademy.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking Jesus and Mohammed with Dr. Adam Francisco. It's not too late for you to register for this weekend's 2020 virtual Making the Case Conference. You can watch Matt Walsh, Katie Faust, Hans Feeney, Mark and Molly Hemingway, Greg Kokel, and Chris Roseborough. The registration allows you both live and on-demand viewing. You can register online at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. How would you basically contrast the teachings and, in particular, the truth claims of Christianity with those of Islam?
Well, one of the biggest divisions is that while both are monotheistic, Islam is resolute in its Unitarian monotheism. There is no, I mean, in the Quran is very clear that God is one, almost like a philosophical monad. There is no plurality within the Godhead. He's just a one thing. Whereas in Christianity, God is one, to be sure, but three persons and one divine being. So you, I mean, doctrinally, on the surface, it makes sense that you, a person who's not averse to theology or anything like that might make the mistake of thinking that, oh, we basically hold the same thing since we're monotheistic. But when you look at the details, it's pretty clear that they're very distinct. In terms of the truth claims, there's lots that could be said here. I think in terms of, let's say, like apologetics, or maybe we could add epistemology, there really is no way to test Islam and its truth claims, at least on the level that you can Christianity, where you can actually go and walk where Jesus walked. Islam asks you to believe it, to believe the whole package, and some maybe would add, or else. Christianity, you know, is proclaimed, and there's, a recognition that if one would believe it, it would be God causing them to believe it. And so there's no, at least doctrinally speaking, that you, there probably are some exceptions, but you won't find examples of Christians trying to persuade non-Christians with some sort of threat of force behind it to embrace Christianity. I'm sure you could find the oddball exception historically, but it can't be so reported by the text.
The four Gospels function in many ways as resurrection accounts with kind of introductions to who's that guy on the cross, mm-hmm. kind of a thing. And it becomes abundantly clear in those four documents that the resurrection is the central truth claim of Christianity. And they serve as testimonies to that, that and the other gospel books. How important is that in understanding the real differences between Islam and Christianity?
It's essentially important. And I mean, it's easy to overemphasize this, but you think of 1 Corinthians 15, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we're the most pitiable of all people because we believed a lie. There's nothing like that in Islam. In fact, I don't know if I can think of a religion off the top of my head that offers, in a way to test or falsify it. And I think you can push this falsification stuff a little too far, but that puts Christianity in the realm of, if you will, objective reality. Like Paul says before Agrippa, when he's accused of being mad in Acts 26, and Paul, your great learning has turned you mad. Would you, in so short a time, think you could convince the king and everyone here to become a Christian? Paul says, I wish I could convince everybody here, because as the king himself knows, what I speak about did not happen in a corner. You know, you can go and check it out. That's not exactly what Paul's saying, but that's kind of what he's saying. And in Islam, there isn't a, in fact, Muslims will oftentimes encourage you not to think too deeply about it. Maybe philosophically think about it, but not to think in terms of facts and the historicity of it. It's either take it or don't.
So we talked earlier at the very beginning of this conversation about how Muhammad regarded Jesus. How does Jesus regard Muhammad?
Can I change that up a bit? How about Paul?
Sure.
Because I think it's a little easier to do. Beginning in Galatians, if you hear a gospel that's different than mine or different than the Christian gospel, even if it's attended by an angel of light, may it be accursed, because it's not a true gospel. I'm adding a little bit there. But in the biography of Muhammad, it's interesting when he's in the cave, when he receives his first revelation, the angel Jibril is there, or Gabriel, and some accounts say it lit up. And if we take gospel as just sort of like religious message in this case, so that's what Paul would think, and I think Jesus would think the same thing. It's a false gospel. It's not even a gospel. And not, like you said at the very beginning, it leads you right to hell.
Dr. Adam Francisco is Assistant Provost for Mission and Identity at Concordia University, Chicago. Next year, he'll be the founding dean of the College of Theology, Arts, and Humanities at CUC. He previously served as a professor in the Department of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He's author of the book, Martin Luther and Islam, and co-editor of Making the Case for Christianity. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next week on Issues Etc., we'll discuss myths about Lutheran worship with Pastor Sean Denzer. We'll have Pastor Will Whedon lead us in a hymn study of Thy Strong Word, and we'll visit with Dr. Jeff Leninger, author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. Making the Case conference registrants, we'll be back in 90 minutes with Matt Walsh, Making the Case Against Woke Culture. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hey Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Jesus the Good Shepherd says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life. We invite you to join us as we listen to the voice of the Good Shepherd and follow him who gives us eternal life. Sunday worship services at 9 a.m., Sunday school and Bible class at 10:30, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri, on the web at goodshepherdarnold.org. That's goodshepherdarnold.org.